Holden Commodore and Ford Falcon prices are out of control. But you'd be a fool to buy a used one at nearly $100,000, or would you? Yes, it's time to strap in for another edition of the Cars Guide podcast, the show that takes you beyond the test drive. This is episode 204, Falcon and Commodore Used Price Madness. I'm Cars Guide Deputy Editor James, and joining me in unpacking these insane Aussie used car values, our key contributor and author of the story we're focusing on, Steve, and our special guest, Aussie motorsport broadcasting legend, journalist, and the man behind the Rusty's Garage podcast, Greg Rust.
James, Stephen, g'day.
We'll also look at the fresh metal we've been driving this week and dive into your feedback. YouTubers, if you want to plot your own adventure, you can jump ahead courtesy of the time codes in the notes below, and you can click on the chapter markers in the timeline. So let's start with a quick update on what you're up to, Rusty. You're speaking to us from Aotearoa. You're living in New Zealand at the moment. What are you up to? Are you going to be over in Australia for Bathurst in December? Other things? What's going on?
James, g'day. My wife is a K1W1, so we've had a place over here since 2015, in fact, actually. We moved in Christmas 2017. So two teenage daughters. We flipped life on its head. We were living in Sydney for many years before that. I'm a Sydney boy, born and bred. The Aussie side of me, and talking about Aussie cars today, that'll never go. They're as popular over here, Commodore and things like that, as they are in Oz. So yeah, we've had a sea change, tree change, whatever you want to call it, couple of acres, and a few animals and things. I'm a terrible farmer, James, but
great, so that's part of the picture as well.
A little bit, yeah. So 2 acres and some sheep and a few other bits and bobs, but nothing fantastic. But very, very different to Sydney. And when there is no COVID, I come and go. I spent 4 months in Oz at the beginning of the year, traveling all over the place, doing different things, a little bit more challenging at the moment. But the goal is to get back in time for Bathurst, yes.
Brilliant, brilliant. What about goats? Do you have goats on the farm? I'm a huge goat fan.
We have tried different things. So we had some goats to begin with, good, but they're incredible escape artists. So,
are they really?
Yes. So that was a little bit of a challenge, and we had some beautiful alpacas for a while, but you've got to really look after them. They can be susceptible to a few things.
Okay.
But a beautiful creature. We didn't feel like they were right for us, with me coming and going with work and things like that. So we've got a nice balance now, five crazy sheep, two dogs, and a ute for running around.
That is fantastic. All right. Well, thank you for that. Let's move on to this soaring market for Aussie metal. And Steve, you authored a story through the week, and it was talking about Falcon and Commodore, as well as the specialist, you know, performance derivatives thereof. And the fundamental question, and you raised the point that people, Ford and Holden stopped manufacturing locally, and of course Holden pulled out altogether, there were people that looking at these cars with the intention of using them as an investment. And the question is, how has that worked out for them? And do you think you've been able to answer that?
Yeah, I think so. Yes and no. I think it's an investment. So there's certainly there's still a lot to play out. You know, I think we're probably only partway through the journey. But yeah, like you say, I mean, I think a lot of people were aware of it at the time. You know, I know personally having discussions with people back in sort of 16, 17 about, what's the best one I should buy for the future? And it's like, you know, my attitude back then was, well, buy the one you want to drive. Like, I mean, that's my attitude towards cars in general, I think, is, you know, drive them. You know, certainly now the market, particularly for, you know, it's really focused on cars like the last, you know, VF Series 2 SSV, SSV Redline. You know, there's still reasonable prices for, say, a Series 1 VF, but it's those later cars that have, I guess, a bit more historical significance that have you know, blown up into like high five figures, low six
figures. So part of it is people wanting the last of the last. I think you made the really great point that it's like an artist who's no longer with us, that you're not going to get any more paintings or whatever it might be out of that person. So there's a limited pool. Same with these cars. And somehow it's the two sides of the same thing. The car that you want to drive is the one that becomes desirable from an investment point of view. And the irony is you probably don't then drive it because of its value. It becomes this hard to juggle equation.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I wrote another piece recently about, personally, I don't like the idea of collecting cars in secondhand garages because I was lucky enough to do the launch of the HSV GTSR W1 at Phillip Island.
Yep.
And I remember talking to their lead engineer at HSV at the time because, they had, with respect to what Ford did, the last FPVs were, probably not as great as they could have been.
They didn't have an entire Corvette rear end under them.
No, they didn't. They changed, they went to all the trouble of, putting the LS9 in. They put in the Super Shocks. They changed tires. They did everything to make it the greatest HSV to drive ever. And people put them in garages, and the engineer at the time was like, said to me, it's just good to see them being driven like this.
That's
because
good.
He knew, he could see then what was going to happen,
And Rusty, what's the profile or visibility of those smaller volume HSVs and FPVs and things in New Zealand? Do they catch your eye occasionally?
They do. And as Stephen's just sort of talked about, very much cherished as well. So there's been a couple of special ones towards the end of the family there, if you like, that have made their way into New Zealand with special numbers, and people have those garaged up, not running up K's on them. So they are treated. You, Stephen, talked about, just getting out, driving them and enjoying them, but people have a real affinity and attachment to them over here. They love Peter Brock going back to the 1980s, so that the attachment to the car is as strong, if not even stronger here. People have got some good stuff tucked away in their garages on the other side of the ditch.
Yeah, and I mean, Steve, you and I were speaking off air, and it's probably a whole other podcast, but it's that kind of affection and people identifying so strongly with that Ford and Holden thing that's causing supercars such a headache at the moment in terms of how do you plot a path forward and away from that, because it's never going to be that way again. But as I say, that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah. But I think the point with this, and I've, again, as we're saying off air, there's another story coming out about this that I've been working on, looking more at those high-end HSV stuff. Because what we're talking about more, is your SSVs and your XR8s that are selling for big dollars. But speaking to some industry, experts in terms of, price values and things like that, there is a belief that, we're in a perfect storm at the moment. This was the last of their kind. Holden has now since disappeared. There's an audience there for them. There's probably a huge portion of the community that, grew up loving Brocky and Dick Johnson and whoever. But also, we've been locked in our country. We can't travel. We can't go and spend our money traveling. We can't, so people are taking the extra money that they have that already, normally might spend on a holiday, and they're going to put it into buying that car that maybe they wanted as a kid. They always wanted that, Falcon or Commodore as a kid. Couldn't afford it, but you know what? Now I'm doing it. I'm just going to dive in.
And can I throw an extension to that? I mean, COVID has meant that a lot of people have got more, not everybody, but people have got more in their pockets to go and spend on that stuff when they can't go on their overseas trip or whatever it might be. But there is a bit of a theory too that because we've been trapped in close confines, that for some people sadly has meant challenges around some relationships. And I think there's been breakdowns in that regard. So some people have emerged from that stuff and gone, I'm going to have a fresh start here.
Right.
We've slipped from that. We've got cash in the pocket. And what? That Commodore I've always wanted, I'm going to go and get it now. And I think there's a bit of that happening too.
It's true, and in lockdown, you're spending far too much time with your partner and kids. Normally, there's 8 hours there where you can take a break and go off to work.
We should speak positively about that, and hopefully that is the case for most people. But I think that is, if you did some homework, we were talking about this on another pod I work on called The Grill the other day, and I think it is a factor. I think it's definitely a factor.
Well, I mean, Steve, you called out the primary example where a pair of HSV GTSR W1 Maloos sold for a combined $2.2 million. And and that's extraordinary money. And you also make the point, in another X number of years, let's call it 15 or 20 years, are they going to be worth more again? Or are the people, are they as in golden and they just become this eternal desirable car? Or are the people that want them aging out of the market and they'll inevitably drop off in price?
Well, I think this is literally the million-dollar question. You know, I think, again, having some conversations that I've had this week, I think there's a view that what you would call the lower end of the market, which are these $100,000 Commodores and Falcons, that is probably gonna die off in the not too distant future. You know, there is supply and demand. So it will sort of dictate. There's not that many people willing to spend, you know, nearly $100,000 on a 4 or 5 year old car. You know,
because you did some digging on our sister entity Auto Trader, and you found, just to go through the stats, there were 290 SSVs for sale, 14 VF SSV red lines advertised. Now you make the point, you can advertise till the cows come home. It's what someone's willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
But they were advertised at more than $80,000, with the highest asking for $99,990. So call it bullish, or just call it that's where the market's going. That's big money for a car like that.
Yeah, that's huge money. But just to go back a step, those W1 Maloos that sold for $2 million.
Yeah.
Basically just over $1 million a piece.
Yes.
I think there is a view that those prices will stay. You know, there's kind of an industry point of view that, you know, once you go over a certain amount, you're probably not really coming back. But even then, we've seen, you know, I think, again, we said off air, you know, you made a very good point that, like, we've seen with, you know, arguably the most blue chip Aussie car to invest in, a phase three Falcon GTHO, they've gone up and down in the last, 10 years.
The GTHO phase three a couple of decades ago hit $1 million and then went off the top of the roller coaster and went way down and became a lot more affordable. And only more recently, they've started to power up to those big levels, big money again. It does go up and down. It's not this, you know, very gradual, predictable kind of staircase of appreciation.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, what is the audience? Because I think the audience is really us here in Australia and people in New Zealand, right?
Sure.
Like it's not like a Ferrari or a you know, Lamborghini that has an international appeal.
And I think to the point you made, Greg, they're cherished, but I imagine it puts me in mind of at one point there when Cadillac in the States was really in the doldrums and the product planners were plotting ahead in terms of their target audience and their primary buyers. And they realized that within about a decade and a half, their primary target market would be dead. And they had to just reinvent themselves and recruit new buyers. But this market, whether or not there's the desire for these cars when we're down the track a bit, when we're all driving electric cars and these, you know, dinosaur old V8s, whether they'll be looked at by kids and younger car enthusiasts.
I think at the very peak of the spectrum or the end of what Stephen's been talking about, not the 100K sort of level, I think you'll find those sort of numbers will either stay, and if they fluctuate, it will only be a small amount, because the reality is no more Holden.
Yep.
Very, very limited number of those cars available. There will be an attachment to it. Even I think we may end up going electric, and that may be what the bulk of kids think about, but there's still going to be that group of passionate types that have looked back on history and are going to go, man, that's special. Look at that thing. Listen to the sound of that thing. Got to have that. And if they've got the income to do it, they'll try and get it.
I don't know about you, Greg, but it's something that I come up against a lot. The argument that says, oh, young kids now are more attached to their phone or their computer than they are to cars. And part of the response is, have you ever been to the Time Attack Challenge, you know, at Sydney Motorsport Park? Have you ever been to a race meeting or a Cars and Coffee or whatever? There are kids everywhere that are every bit as into cars as I was at their age. I think there will be an ongoing interest and passion in cars as whatever happens in terms of alternate propulsion, I think these cars will still hold a fascination.
And it's just a question of percentages. So you might be talking there about the bulk of the population, the bulk of kids now, and as they become adults, will certainly think that way. But there'll be absolutely a, maybe not a niche, maybe it'll be slightly bigger than that. There'll be a sector that have that passion and that want and desire and that knowledge. That, you know, when you talk to them, when you go to Time Attack and things like that, their knowledge around the history, the technical aspects of it, I mean, they're immersed in it. They're absolutely immersed in it. So I think that sector will always be there. It's just a question of how big it is relative to the whole population.
That's a good point.
Well, it's funny you guys bring that up, right? The whole Time Attack culture, which is largely built around, you know, the Japanese cars, you know, the JDM models that are, which is probably the next trend. You know, it's probably the next, you know, we see now, the 90s GTRs now selling for big bucks, the old Supras.
Totally.
You know, those kind of cars are probably the next, key market, because you're probably getting those blokes that are probably around, you know, my age more and financially more successful than I am, that can afford to go out and splurge on that car that they wanted as a kid, you know. And
yes,
like, you know, I think there's a generation certainly around my kind of vintage, maybe slightly younger, that see, you know, personally, I'm not a huge fan of the Fast and the Furious franchise.
Right.
But there are people that for a generation of kids and car loving kids, those are seminal films, you know.
Yes.
And so the cars in those films are, you know, well, I would love a Bullet Mustang. Mm. They want to grow up and get, you know, Fast and Furious Boys Supra or whatever.
The thing that gets me, though, is I'm a person of a certain age, and unlike you, Steve, as a septuagenarian, I'm not quite there yet. But the cars that were in my childhood, utterly ordinary. They were just almost like a disposable object, are now just held up as shining jewels, you know, in the used car market. I find it hard to get my head around some of those.
So James and Stephen, for me, where's the next value one that we find? Where's the one when you look at it and you go, oh, that's undervalued, that'll take off, or that'll become popular or whatever. I mean, someone said to me the other day, what about RX-8s? And the value of them now relative to other rotaries that have taken off and gone crazy in price, you know? So where's the next one you could dive on, get, restore, that'll become a thing with people and that represents to buy now something, you know, pretty reasonable value for money?
I tell you what, I have a particular car in mind, which I think if I was going to splurge on a car that I could potentially, you know, use as a nest egg or hand down to my kids for them to sell for $1 million in 20 years, it would be a first gen Tesla Roadster. Think about it, right?
Wow.
Like it's a groundbreaking car, whether you like Tesla or not. And you know, I don't want to be attacked by the cult of
Teslarati.
you know, it was a groundbreaking car. It was a car that established a very established a new brand that, as we've just discussed, has a very popular following and a very diehard following. And it was built in limited numbers. I've kept an eye on them. And, you know, a couple of years ago, you could get one for, you know, about 99, and now they're about 190. So they're headed up already, you know. So for me,
it's amazing. I find it a hateful thing. I remember driving it and it was awful.
Well, that's the bonus of it is I wouldn't really want to drive it. Like
no,
it was okay,
it's great.
But
you
it
can
was,
just put it
I
aside,
didn't hate but, yeah. it, but you know, like certainly it's, you know, for me personally, I would rather have a SSV Redline.
like, yeah, right. Well, that's a good tip then. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that to me, like that seems like, you know, this is the thing. This is investing. You know, there's no
story, aura, for all the reasons you just mentioned. That's what will make it appealing.
That's very good.
Do we actually need a little footnote there that Stephen is not a financial planner and, you know, takes advice?
None of this is advice. Not just financial things. None of this is advice. Don't take any notice at all.
Just to be clear, this is now on record and I'm going to come back and look at this in 20 years when Tesla Roadsters are selling for $5 million. So,
I actually think some of the, for what it's worth, I think some of the, what are currently perceived as the lesser Porsches, you know, the front engine rear wheel drives, 944s, even some of the higher end 924s, they're still broadly you know, if you want to call it that, affordable. But I think over time they're going to rise in value. Just my theory.
Yeah. I mean, I would support that and say sort of the stuff that me is like the last naturally aspirated, you know, Carreras, you know, the 993. I mean, like the 991.1.
Oh, righto. Okay.
You know, but just because you remember the first, they did that first run. It still had the naturally aspirated cars, and then they introduced the turbo with the facelift.
Yep. That's a good call.
So to me,
too.
It's like, you know, those naturally aspirated Porsches, like, you know, a 718 GT4, or, you know, they're the kind of cars to me that I think people will crave, you know, like a Ferrari 458 is probably going to be a highly desirable Ferrari in 20 years compared to something like a 488.
Because it's naturally aspirated.
Naturally aspirated.
And the sound of that engine, I remember the first time driving that car, it was otherworldly, so fabulous. So that's a really good call too. Yeah. That's put it right in everybody's ballpark. Thanks.
Yeah, Steve. I think it's just really like, I like to give a lot of grassroots advice here. So
that's right. But some of the others, just before we move on, some of the others you called out. We've got a GTSR, just to stick with HSV for a while.
Yeah.
You had a low kilometre example, like as in 47 kilometres. That's pretty much delivery mileage. Let's call it $300,000, $1 under it. And you made the point that even with 50K on the clock, that's 240 grand. And you can turn around and buy an M5 BMW competition for that money. Yeah. So that's an interesting kind of equation as well. I don't know what your BMW M5 will be worth a few years down the track, but that's a lot of dough.
Yeah. And this is actually kind of the you know, what I was saying before, the irony about HSV building the W1, they didn't have to. The GTSR with just a new bumper bar was going to become a collector's item anyway. You know, there's a certain collector's appeal, historical significance, to just it being the last HSV Commodore. So
Well, you also call it, like, back in 2014, FPV GTF 351, they're now being advertised for around 180 grand and they sold new for 78. Yeah. That's pretty spectacular. Back in 2008, FPV GTP, that's crept up a bit, but not quite as spectacularly. The original price was 75,990. And what are we looking at now? Just under 90 grand. So that's only a fairly gradual kind of creep up. So it's a little bit patchy in terms of how people are going at it.
But the key thing there is they've gone up. Yes. You know, cars lose value as soon as you drive them off the lot. These cars have gone. So I think, you know, honestly, power to them. If these people the people selling these cars can get these kind of returns on them, hey.
Well, I mean, to that point, you mentioned that even an XR8, the last XR8 are holding their original price. So, yes, that is rare. You're absolutely right.
Honey, trust me, this is going to go up in value.
that's right. Yes, this is our superannuation. Yes, you'll love it.
It's a funny one because I did have a mate who was a diehard Holden fan who always wanted to buy a new Commodore, you know, had a bunch of Commodores over his life, but they're always, you know, used.
Yes.
And so the SSV Redline, I think, is what he really wanted. And, you know, he looked at it as 60 grand. Like that is a big investment for a lot of people.
Yep.
You know, in hindsight, he could have driven it for, 4 years and got his money back.
Got his money back.
You know,
yes, like, had free transport
maybe
for
even
a few
turned
years.
A little bit, you know, a little bit of a profit. So, you know, if anything, you know, I think I made the Joni Mitchell reference at the start of the story. It's sort of, you know, it's sad that we didn't appreciate what we had until it was gone. I think a lot of people unfortunately have realized that, you know, Holden and Ford, these were great cars.
Yes.
I don't think any of us, we've all driven them. They were world-class cars.
Driven them, owned them. And it's dragged right through Holden, particularly because the company doesn't exist anymore. Has really got people motivated, and older Holdens in good shape are drawing enormous used car values, as well as and locally made Falcons and what have you. Locally made Toyota Camrys, not so much.
I didn't look into those, to be honest, though. I don't know if they're selling for, like, you might have to, TDR Orients might be going for 100K. Who knows?
We'll have to
deep dive.
Yeah, that's another story. that's another story. All right, good discussion. Thank you, guys. We'll now move into our garage. And I think, Steve, I'd like to just kick off with you in terms of what you've been driving in the last week or so. It's got the capacity for quite a few people. I don't know whether you've been filling it up, but tell us about it, please.
I have been rocking the Kia Carnival the last week. And
family man.
Yeah, that I am. Man of the people.
Yes. Yeah.
I got to tell you, like, because I drove it in part because I'd just driven the Staria, just done the review for Cars Guide on the Staria, so you can check that out.
Reference, thank you.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of get back into it because the Staria, you know, they made a big song and dance about how it was, you know, it's on an SUV platform and how much it's much more like an SUV than it's much more of a, like, people mover than a commercial van now, but you're driving it, you know, it's still a van, right? It's still the size of a van. Whereas, so I wanted to sort of reacquaint myself with the Carnival and, you know, it is, to be honest, it's a fantastic car. It's a really, really good, like if you've got a family, like I've said to people have asked me in the past, you know, other, you know, when they find out I'm the car guy, you know, the school drop-offs, whatever, the mums are like, you know, what's a good car? I always say, honestly, if you need to transport more than, you know, three kids on a regular basis, get a Carnival.
Because
it's got the people space and it's got the luggage space. And I was lucky enough to have the Platinum, so it's fully loaded. But, you know, just in general, just the space of it is fantastic.
Because I've often said to my wife, look, the day I suggest that we get a people mover, just slip something in cornflakes and get me out of here because life's over as we know it. But
yeah.
That Carnival has turned that on its head because it's much more car-like. It's quite appealing to look at, you know, just superficially. It's a terrific design, but also in the way it operates, it's a very composed and easy to drive package.
Yeah, it's like a, you know, it's done what Hyundai really wanted to do, which is drive more like an SUV or just a big wagon. I actually think, honestly, it might even be on my lotto list. If I won lotto, I honestly, you know, it'd be a hard thing to go past in terms of just as a load lugger, right? Like
that'd be a relatively modest lotto win, wouldn't it? You're talking about winning
the show now,
thing?
James. End the show now. There's your headline. If I win lotto, I'm off.
I'll buy
a
Carnival.
I'll be honest. I'll probably buy some other cars. But
there may be. Yeah, maybe.
But you know, just in terms of like. You know, the, like I said, the Platinum, you know, is fully loaded, and it, you know, it really is sort of the zenith of Kia has, I think, a remarkable ability to build thoughtful cabins, you know, like useful, practical, like it's got the storage where you need it. It's got, you know, you know, the controls, it's got, you know, like the USB port is next to a spot where you can put your phone and you can cover it up and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, USB ports in the back for the kids and all that sort of stuff. So it's, yeah, to me, it sort of like is the ideal.
It's just, you know, thoughtful. It's just thoughtful. Yeah,
and
great.
Unsurprisingly, it outsells every other people mover by, like, you know, a factor
a zillion to one. Yeah,
I don't know it in the detail that Stephen does, but a little quick little story for you. Over time, with the commentators in the Supercars coverage and at Channel 10 and so on, we would invariably all end up going somewhere together. In the early days, always Tarragos from hire car companies, but as time went on, it often became the Carnival, and you can absolutely see the way that it's evolved, improved, and so on over the years, Steve, can't you?
Oh yeah, like it was, like you know, to be honest, like most Kias from 10, 15 years ago, you know, in the last two or three generations, they have leapt forward. Like they are a completely different car company, and it shows on the, you know, shows in the
Isn't it interesting, Greg, you mentioned that the Tarago, when it was retired from the Australian market, there were general news stories on evening bulletins that the Tarago had left the market. It's really extraordinary, the affection people had for that car. It was selling in like handfuls of numbers. It was very unpopular toward the end of its run, but it was a big deal in its day.
We have some wonderful memories that I can't really share on this podcast. A lot of fun along the way. But I mean, you know, you can imagine piling Lee Diffie, Daryl Beattie, Neil Compton, Matthew White, and all those guys, and the stories that are will remain forever in those carnivals and
very good.
And Tarragos is exactly where they should be too.
If only that Tarrago could speak. Yes.
What happens in the Tarrago stays in the
Tarrago. That's right.
Well, that's good. Now, thank you very much, Steve. Was there anything else you wanted to add on
the
carnival?
No,
we're there. Very good. Now, Rusty, we'll move to your good self. You've one-upped just about everyone that's certainly in the podcast or listening or watching. You've been driving a certain performance-focused vehicle. Fill us in, please.
Oh, I'm very fortunate. I spent, as we talked about at the top, a few months in Australia at the beginning of the year. So I drove different cars in that time, Supra, you name it. But I ended that period before I came back to New Zealand in a 911 Turbo S, and I had the most amazing week in that. Just brought back some great memories. I was hoping to put a background up for you today of a day I spent at Winton many years ago driving a Carrera Cup car. So
unreal.
I play fair. I don't have manufacturer alliances with anybody. I often drive different things. My road car guys at home around the property is a Navara STX. But over time I've wanted to restore an older Porsche, and I've never done that, a Porsche. And my wife actually, Sarah, gave me the green light many years ago before they went crazy in price, and Terry, tight, Rusty, balked and didn't do it, and they've now tripled in price.
I see.
So
I see.
Big mistake. Big mistake.
Right.
That
right.
would have been a nice resto project now that I'm in my early 50s.
So what, just in the name of science and satisfying yourself, did you experiment with the launch control on the Turbo S?
I may have done, yes.
Right.
So, yes. I was told that it would be the most mind-blowing sensation. I may or may not have been direct messaged by a certain ex-Formula One driver that does some things around the Porsche landscape and thoroughly recommended to try that. So advice was heeded. Yes, amazing, you know, amazing car.
That's really interesting. At the launch, I want to say it was 992 Turbo. Help me out, Steve. When the GT3 engine drama happened with Porsche 911, do you recall what generation that was? Because that's when it was. Anyway,
we
were at Phillip Island and fanging around the circuit in these 911s and turbos and Turbo S's. And, yes, Mark Webber turned up and he started to do some taxi drives for journos that were there. And over time I've gone around Phillip Island a lot. You tend to know the layout and you think you can get around there okay. And as we're firing down pit lane, he says, I haven't been here since I was driving Formula Ford. And absolutely lit the place up. Like,
awesome.
It was pretty much his first hot lap. And it was like the difference between mortal people and, yes. and people like him. It was fantastic. Yeah. He was really putting that car on the edge of its performance envelope straight away.
They are great days, those, in reminding you how far away you are from the pros.
Totally.
You have, miles to learn. I find them mentally exhausting. They can be physical, but I find them mentally exhausting days too, because you absorb so much, you take in so much from those guys. And even if there's one little nugget on the day that you improve on,
Couldn't agree more. That's a win.
That's a win.
Totally.
I always love those days when they have like a lead car. Certain brands like to have a lead car with an instructor on the radio talking to you, and they always say, "Oh, look, if you keep with us, we'll go a bit faster. You catch up, we'll go a bit faster." And I sort of think to yourself, "Oh, I'm going all right here. I'll keep it up. We're going a bit quick." And then you realize, "Oh, they're doing it one-handed."
Yeah, that's right. And talking to you on the radio.
Yeah, and you're like, "Yeah, never mind."
But
that's,
I mean,
so much more to learn.
Give me 150 laps with that person in the passenger seat coaching me along the way, and I might get within cooey of what they're doing. But they just get in the car. That's the difference between a pro and a warrior is they just get in and go fast immediately. It's amazing. But yeah, fantastic.
Just back to Rusty's, working class 911 Turbo.
Yep.
how many seats did that have, huh?
What do you mean?
Only two and a half, not that eight. Like,
that's right. You win playing, that. It's a slam on the seat count.
They'll be laughing with their lotto winnings, huh?
Yes.
I buy both of those, actually.
So suddenly, Stephen turns up to the next Cars Guy episode of our podcast, and there he is rocking up in a brand new Ferrari or Porsche. Did he win the lotto after all?
Yeah, that's right. That's when push comes to shove. All right, I'll wrap things up because I've been in a Hyundai Tucson It's the diesel all-wheel drive Elite, about 45K. So it's a five-seat SUV, two-litre turbo diesel, four-cylinder, eight-speed auto, and all-wheel drive, but on demand. So it defaults to, I want to say, it'd be front-wheel drive, and then we'll go to all-wheel drive. 137 kilowatts, about 4,000 RPM, so reasonably steep. 416 newton metres, which is pretty handy for a car that weighs about 1.67 tonnes. And nice and low, 2,000 RPM is where that peak starts to arrive. It's not exactly huge. It's a mid-size, 4.6 metres long. And on the plus side, it gets up and goes. That engine, which is used in various Hyundai and Kia products, really gets up and goes. And the tow weight for a relatively modest SUV is 1.9 tonnes, which is pretty handy. And it has standard trailer stability control. So, and good steering feel, lots of space for the footprint that it actually occupies, and lots of practicality built in, and a big boot. We got lots of luggage and a big bulky pram in there all at one go, with a little bit of room to spare. And this car at 45K, it's pretty loaded up. You've got leather appointed seats, dual zone climate control, all I could go on. And you get a full-size alloy spare, which I always love. You know, you get the full-size spare. The minuses, there aren't many. At that money, I would have liked to have seen an auto tailgate, but, hey, who can't open their own tailgate? It's just one of those nice-to-have things. A little bit noisy, but not chronically so for a turbo diesel. The angular styling, I think people will either see it as a bit fussy or cool. It might be somewhat polarizing, but I quite like it for what it's worth. The push-button transmission controls on the console, I'm not a fan of that. I'd prefer a more conventional shifter, particularly when you're in three-point turn type situations and you want to swap between the gears quickly. And the big media screen looks really cool, but there's no physical volume knob for the radio, which I always like, because, yes, there's a little up and down switch on the wheel, but if you want to adjust the volume quickly, there's nothing quite like being able to just go over and kind of turn it down with the dial. So just nitpicking, really. I thought it was a really good drive, and I enjoyed driving it for the week for sure.
Oh, I think they've positioned themselves for the younger people we were talking about in this podcast, James. Probably. You and I and even Stephen want that volume control, but kids, you know, it's all about that.
All got to be, slick exactly. And haptic and like the smartphone,
Yeah, it's interesting, the interesting point you make about the styling. I think Hyundai in general, you know, they've really sort of push the boat out, you know, in the sort of latest generation of cars. And it kind of, to me, it's I think someone else said it to me, it does straddle the line between nice design and like over the top. Like it's sort of, to me, it's sort of right on that knife's edge of whether or not it's a good looking car or it's just a.
Do you know the other interesting point? I was talking to a designer who said that Hyundai's direction, when you have those large surfaces that are at different angles, say along the side of the car, and they intersect, you know, door shut lines and what have you go through them, it's very hard to get high quality with that kind of shape. So it's a conscious decision that says this is going to be difficult to achieve, but we're going to do it anyway, even in a mainstream kind of mass model, which is, you know, hats off for that.
Yeah. I mean, think again, like I said about Kia, think about, you know, the Tucson two, three generations ago, you know, it was not a particularly desirable car. And now it's a really, you know, like it's certainly a more premium look, whether it is probably more polarizing, but it's certainly, like you say, it's a more complicated, you know, all those crease lines and style lines.
It's difficult to execute.
Yeah. Like says, this is a high quality vehicle that we've built. You know, we haven't taken the easy option here.
Interesting arm wrestle there too, in that Kia is a hair's breadth away from stepping ahead of Hyundai in sales month to month. So that's been a long time coming, but it's getting to a very interesting point. All right. Now, thank you for that, guys. We'll move on to feedback from last week. And last week we were talking about the next-gen Ranger. Ford has been strategically teasing images of its next-gen Ranger, which is going to be released before the end of this year, but arrive in our market next year. And obviously it's a huge deal because it's one of the top selling vehicles in an arm wrestle with Hilux and others. But places to see came back at us and said, the new Ranger hopefully will have the V6 diesel option available in the cheaper models, not just the top of the line. And I think the bad news there, places to see, is that our mail is it's not so much. It's going to be the 2-litre turbo diesel that we now have will be in the base cars, and the V6s will be in the higher ones. Is that your understanding too, Steve?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think that's sort of the logical take on it.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I guess Volkswagen, because obviously this is going to be paired with the Volkswagen Amarok. Volkswagen do have that Amarok Core V6.
Yep.
So I guess there's
maybe there's a bit of cross shopping to be had there.
Yeah, I mean, potentially,
you know, configuration you want.
Yeah, I mean, does you know, I don't know what the obviously the details of their partnership are. Is there an opportunity for Ford to try and match that with a, you know, a relatively a modestly equipped V6 model, you know?
Yeah, and maybe as time goes by, pep it up with something like that.
I would think, though, the logic kind of suggests that, you know, like you say, it's going to be sort of 4-cylinder for the entry-grade cars and yes. 6 for the higher spec.
Yes. Now, Outlandish Rig says, forget the vehicles head-to-head. And by that, I'm sure he means Ranger and Hilux. Ford customer service will take a long time to shake its past and present. Ranger is the only vehicle keeping it from rolling off the cliff in Australia. To that, I'd say that Ford in September ascended to third place in sales in terms of brands in the Aussie market. So it's now ahead of Hyundai. No doubt that Mustang and Ranger were marquee models for Ford in Australia, but they're seemingly substantiating that a little bit. They're selling more Rangers than ever before. But service. They put in a loan car program. They've been very big on trying to capture some ground back on all of that. But I suppose it's a fair point.
Yeah, I don't own one, boys, but the you know, when you deal with them invariably, you know, picking up a car or whatever. I mean, it always seems to be something that is very smooth from that side. So
okay.
Customer service versus some of the model sales that you're talking about, I guess, are two different subjects, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, there's no better way to retain a customer than to have a good relationship ongoing. And all of the emphasis on getting the car off the showroom floor and into someone's hands, but then once they own it, your opportunity is to you know, win their loyalty.
The salesman sells you the first one.
Yes,
the service department is going to see the second or the third.
Exactly.
So I have a bit of experience here because I personally don't own a Ford, but my mother owns a Focus.
All right.
And I was it's actually been interesting watching her because her experience with it. I was part of that. You know, I remember Ford put on a big show for us when they made it. They wanted to make an effort about service. You know, under previous management, they started this big push of free loan cars and you know, all that extra sort of going the extra mile,
marketing it on mass media as well. This is a big deal.
You know, certainly I think it took a while for that to trickle down. You know, there were some issues. You know, I remember, you know, when she got her serviced, I said, oh, and they gave you the loan car, and she said, no loan car.
Ooh, I was like, well, okay.
You know, you should have that. And it's like, you know, a lot of it's, you know, she didn't know to ask, you know, but they really, if that's going to be their thing, they should be offering it, right? It should be a...
Have you ever thought to mic her up before she goes in for a service and actually get the interaction on tape?
Well, unfortunately, now they know I'm her son. And so it has been... I think there's been an improvement. I think the key there is, I think that Ford has acknowledged it was a problem in the past and are trying to fix it, you know, and I think that's really, I'm giving one specific example. Who knows?
Yep.
You know, there might be the fact that they're selling a lot of Rangers and they're selling a lot of, you know, some other models suggests that maybe they are doing a better job of keeping people happy. So, you know, I think it's certainly it's not the work of a moment, but they have been at it now a couple of years. It was several years ago when they did that big...
Yep. And takes a while for something like that to wash through, you know, for perceptions to dissipate and for experiences, better experiences to happen and change the whole thing. It does take time.
Good feedback, Stephen. Good feedback. Yeah. Real world.
Now Deatomizer, to quote him, says, Hilux is so overrated. Uncomfortable plastic interior, inflated sticker price, made him buy an Everest. So Deatomizer bought an Everest. 4 years and 130,000 kilometers later, it's as solid and dependable as ever. He was behind a newer Prado and, quote unquote, nearly choked to death from the white smoke pouring out of its exhaust. So glad with his purchase decision. And there was then a comments cage fight in response to that, where the likes of Jay Gus and Miguel Duterte and de-atomizer got back in there, and it was all about retained value of an Everest. And I think it was Miguel called it a second-gen territory and no one would want to buy it. And it all boiled down to de-atomizer saying it's all academic because I'm going to hang on to it more or less forever anyway, so who cares? But he's very much against the Hilux and into the Ford product.
I actually drove before the Carnival. I had a Hilux, and it was a good opportunity to remind myself. It's actually quite bizarrely for Australia's best-selling vehicle, I think it is in some ways underrated. We generally think of, the Amarok has probably the best ride and handling package of a ute in terms of it's the nicest to drive with the Ranger not far behind that. But to be honest, I don't think the Hilux is a million miles away. I think it actually drives quite nicely for what it is. It's still a ute. It's still supposed to have a lot of capability. So you're going to get a little bit of a jittery ride at times when you're unladen. But I think it steers nice. I think that 2.8, I had the Rogue, so it had that had different rear suspension, but they've introduced that more powerful motor across the lineup. So it's got 500 newton meters. It's 150 kilowatts, 500
newton meters. That's plenty.
It goes all right. Like, you're not expecting a sports car,
And Greg, in making your Navara, it was Navara, wasn't it? In making your Navara decision, did you experience the Hilux?
This is actually a really timely conversation because the Navara has been for, around the property, but also for, teenage kids, school runs. It's done the works, but it's at the point now where I am contemplating what to do next. Mm. And I still want that dual cab four-wheel drive. The obsession that we have with them in this space is incredible.
To be fair, you do live on a farm though.
Not really. I mean, I am not, we need to highlight underscore not a farmer, but it is hugely handy for stuff like that around the place. But the kids still want to get in something that's comfortable, that rides nice with connectivity, all of that stuff. They look at Amarok, they look at Ranger, and there's a bit of want there. So, I've had a good experience with that Navara, and it's still, I've got a bit of a soft spot for it still.
Yeah. Oh, good. Very good. I mean, there are plenty of people in exactly the same boat that are Navara devotees for sure. Now, Grudland 74, a regular correspondent, we touched on electric utes last week, and he said, I'd love to hear Crafty's opinion on Rivian. Now, obviously, Rivian's created a lot of buzz about electric utes and SUV. So I got in touch with Crafty. It's hard. You have to go through his management and whatnot. But eventually,
I thought he was only contactable by carrier pigeon too.
That's right.
Morse code.
Anyway, by whatever means, we managed to converse yesterday. And to paraphrase what he said to me, he said, look, as always, he'll reserve judgment until he actually drives it. But on paper, it seems to tick pretty much all the boxes. Range is about 600 kilometers, tows 4.5 tons, good ground clearance. But as with any newcomer, it's when you hit the sand and the corrugations that things get interesting. So he's looking forward to steering one. And hopefully that answers your initial thought anyway, Grudlin. Oh. But yeah, sorry, man.
Sorry, yeah, what I would add, because I was lucky enough to see the Rivian I guess it was New York Motor Show.
It had to be a couple of years ago.
I want to say 2019.
Okay.
Before the dark times.
And
speaking to their then chief engineer, and he sort of was able to give us a bit of a look around it. I think one of the key thing to remember with the Rivian is it's a premium ute. It's like the interior fit and finish. It's very much, it's not really the kind of,
would you call that a luxury ute?
Yeah, I mean, it really is kind of a luxury ute, right? Like, it's certainly going to compete with more of the, Hilux Rogue and your Ram 1500s and Chevy Silverados and things like that in terms of not quite that big, but just in terms of its its design and its fit and finish and those kind
and
of things.
Probably price positioning.
And that's the thing people are going to remember. The price is going to be up there. It's not going to be a. It's not going to be, you know, $29,000, $45,000.
Yeah, that's right.
4x2. But I mean, it does seem incredibly capable. I actually, because I recently watched Ewan McGregor, Charlie Borman special where they rode electric motorbikes from the tip of Argentina all the way up to America.
Okay.
And they had Rivian support vehicles, which at the time were prototypes. And they beat them up, you know, like these were like literally the first hand-built
prototypes. Built ones. Wow.
And they dragged them all the way through South America. And, you know, so they've certainly made it off-road capable. You know, it's not a, when I say it's a luxury ute, it's not a pretty like drive.
Well, look, there's South roads. America end to end, and then there's crafty. Okay. Yeah. So stand by. All right. Now, then we got two other really interesting ones. Samuel Baker came at us and said, another great episode. So thank you, Samuel. He needs to settle an argument. He has a 1998 Mazda BJ323 Estina, 200,000 kilometers on the clock. Not immaculate, but outside it's clean, few shopping trolley dents, nothing that can't be buffed or touched up. The interior is excellent, no stains, fading or cracks. Everything works. The Mazda's avoided the child interior decimation because they bought another bigger car. So a mate of his told his 11-year-old son that Samuel's Mazda was a quote-unquote old bomb. He says he can't accept this. A bomb blows smoke, Uncle Buck style, and unlocks with any key or starts with a screwdriver, has torn seats, et cetera, et cetera. Is my Mazda 323 a bomb?
What version is it? Is it the SP? Is that the question we need to ask?
No. Well, he said it's just a 323 Estina. So I don't think we're talking about an SP or a performance variant here. It's the cooking version.
Cooking version I struggle with. I SP mean, would be
if it's well maintained. I think the key to a bomb is really the maintenance, right?
Yes.
You know, does it have an odor coming from the boot? You know, like is it full of?
Well, I mean, one person's perception of a bomb could be that anything that's not new, you know, anything that doesn't have the latest safety tech or doesn't have the latest load of equipment and all of that, everything else is a bomb.
I think that's a bit snooty.
I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of the person that has denigrated Samuel's car.
Yeah, let's stay out of those shoes. I think that doesn't sound like a bomb. Sounds like it's been well looked after.
Sounds like it's a decent car.
You know, like I think it's got to be blowing smoke. It's got to be full of like Macca's wrappers. It's got to have a mismatched panel probably. Like
stereo doesn't work.
Yeah, a hubcap missing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like a coat hanger for the antenna, like that sort of stuff. That's a bomb. You know?
Good.
Like
okay, so Samuel,
clean, well maintained.
Suffice to say, we're on your side. You're not driving a bomb.
Stand up for your 323, Samuel.
Correct.
Be nice to Samuel too on socials too on all our feedback. Be nice. Play nice.
Now, lastly, last correspondent that we're going to deal with today, with the popularity now, it's Paul Victor, and I think he's raised an interesting point. With the popularity of plug-in hybrids increasing, especially in SUVs and proper four-wheel drive vehicles to come increasingly as well, I'd say, how are you going to see the true hours a car runs? Let's say Prado comes out sometime in the future with a hybrid diesel where you have a range of 100 kilometres electric only. That'd be excellent for city driving and using the engine-electric combo only on highways or beach or outback. How do you measure the hours the diesel engine has actually run? I can see maybe a future where you have an hour meter for the engine like tractors and the normal odometer for overall kilometers. It will make secondhand car market interesting. It's something that hadn't occurred to me at all, that the engine will have potentially fewer hours on it than the car has kilometers under the treads. Rusty.
You could think of this like, helicopters or something like that, where you look at, hours on the motor. Can I also say, I reckon this is going to be driven, pardon the pun, by kids, because my kids will only do 2-hour trips. I used to go with my mum and dad when I was a little tacker. I would go Sydney to Gold Coast. We'd do the massive road trip. Two, I reckon the 2 hours tops, they're done.
Yes. Yep. Yes. My wife recounts going on a trip from Sydney to Brisbane in the back of her dad's Valiant Safari, and her position was to lie on the back of the load you know, in the boot, basically, that's where she'd lie. So we're talking pre-seatbelts. And they had a nose-tail accident. She was showered with glass, just lying there. Like, and the glass just... Anyway, that's another story.
I mean, it's an interesting point, but I guess we just have to... Yeah, I mean, I guess we've already started to see this kind of thing with hybrids as they are. You know, they are taking a little bit of, you know, if you take 10 minutes a day out of your engine, it is what it is. But, you know, I'm sure car makers will come up with a, you know, there's ways to look after engines and know, you know, roughly where they're at in terms of their life cycle.
Yes. I suppose if you were a cynic, you'd say an engineer is also very good at engineering to a price. And if they know that this engine's only going to be used for a certain percentage of the time, maybe it'll be constructed differently.
Potentially.
Anyway,
that would be a conversation, though, when it comes to buying and how many hours is it done?
That's it.
Yeah.
What are the hours?
Yeah,
exactly. I
mean, with modern cars, they'd probably just add in an hours meter. Like you said, you know, you could just be part of the trip computer, you know, like overall.
How many hours on the engine?
It's driven 10,000 kilometers, but it's only done, you know,
It'd no doubt be in there, and all you'd need is an FBI agent to, you know, take it out and extract the information. The data would be there.
Well, yeah, because Subaru does it. The Subaru has a there's something similar. They had a clock on stop start on their early models. I remember the early models, it'd stop, and that little counter had come up on the dash saying, you know, you've been stopped.
I was in an Outback just recently, and so it'll tell you how long you've had the engine stopped while you're stationary and how many milliliters of fuel you haven't used because you've been stopped.
So I'm sure that data is buried in there and it just needs to just be presented.
Great. You know? All right. Well, there it is. We've solved that problem already, Paul Victor. And with that, we have reached the finish line. So I want to say thank you for joining, Rusty. And thank you, Steve. And thanks to our robot whisperer, happiness advocate, and paranoid in chief, Mr. Pritchard, for his otherworldly production skills. Today, he's wearing a T-shirt saying, "Real men smell like diesel," floral trousers, and elf shoes. It's an incredible combination, as usual. Jump into the conversation. Cars Guide is on Facebook and Instagram, or email us at comments@carsguide.com.au. Apple Podcast listeners, please take a moment to rate and review the show. 5 is the preferred number of stars. Thank you. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to subscribe to the Cars Guide YouTube channel so you can stay on top of all our latest content. But before we go, bloke I know loved tractors. Speaking of this, Rusty, he was a farmer, so he had several, but he also had tractor models, tractor books, tractor wallpaper. He wore tractor pajamas to bed. And his wife didn't have a problem with it. She loved tractors too. But in a sad, incredibly ironic twist, she was killed by a tractor falling off the back of a transport in the town near where they lived. From that instant, he couldn't stand tractors, sold the farm with the tractors, all the paraphernalia, moved to the big city and started a new life. Time passed, and although his departed wife still occupied a special place in his heart, he eventually got back out there, was on his first date. It was dinner in a small cafe, good wine, great food, but it was very smoky. Turns out his date was asthmatic and becoming increasingly distressed. So my mate started just drawing in the smoke, inhaling it in big breaths until the room was clear and he moved outside to kind of let it all go. When he came back inside, his date asked, "That was amazing. How on earth did you do that?" To which he said, "It's no problem. I'm an extractor fan."
We've covered some ground in this podcast today, from Stephen spending lotto money on a Kia Carnival to hour meters on electric cars. My first car that I got a license on was a baby shit brown VC Commodore. And based on what Stephen talked about at the commencement of the podcast, that will not be one that's gone up in value. We don't have that anymore. It's gone.
All right. Oh, good on you. Thank you, guys.
Oh, man. Thank you.